Hiding him? How do I know? Why'd he get in touch? I have no idea. The call was interrupted before he got to that. We continued in this monotonous, circular fashion till I thought I'd drop. Quintana was unfailingly civil, unsmiling, persistent, nay, relentless, and finally agreed to let me go back to the motel only after he'd milked me of all conceivable information. "Miss Milhone, let me make one thing crystal clear," he said, shifting in his seat. "This is a police matter. We want Bailey Fowler back in custody. I better not find out you're helping him in any way. Do you understand that?"
"Absolutely," I said.
He gave me a look that said he doubted my sincerity. I staggered back to bed at 6:22 a.m. and slept until 9, which was when Anne tapped on my door and got me up.
End of Disc 3. Disc 4.
Chapter 14. Anne was on her way to the hospital to see her father. The house cleaner, Maxine, had been delayed, but swore she'd be there by 10. In the meantime, Anne felt Ori was too anxious to be left alone.
"I've called Mrs. Maud. She and Mrs. Emma agreed to sit with Mother, but neither one can make it till this afternoon. I feel like a dog asking you to fill in."
"Don't worry about it. I'll be right down."
"Thanks."
I still had my clothes on, so I didn't have to waste any time getting dressed. I brushed my teeth and threw some water on my face, ignoring the dark smudges around my eyes. There was a time in my youth when staying up all night had felt adventuresome. Dawn then was exhilarating, and there didn't seem to be any end to the physical resources at my command. Now the lack of sleep was creating an odd high that foreshadowed a stomach-churning descent. I was still on the upswing, gathering momentum as I dragged my body out. Coffee might help, but it would only postpone the inevitable crash. I was going to pay for this. Ori was sitting up in bed, fussing with the ties on her gown. Paraphernalia on the night table and the faint scent of alcohol indicated that Anne had done Ori's glucose test and had already administered her morning dose of insulin. The trace of blood streaked on the reagent strip had dried to a rusty brown. Old adhesive tape was knotted up on the bed tray like a wad of chewing gum. Stuck to it was a cotton ball with a linty-looking dot of red. This before breakfast. Mentally, I could feel my eyes cross, but I bustled about in my best imitation of a visiting nurse. I was accustomed from long experience to steeling myself to the sight of violent death, but this residue of diabetic odds and ends nearly made my stomach heave. Resolutely, I swept it all into a plastic wastebasket and tucked it out of sight, tidying pill bottles, water glass, carafe, and ace bandages. Usually, Ori had her legs bound in heavy pink stretch wraps, but she was apparently airing them today. I avoided the sight of her mottled calves, the ice-cold feet in which so little circulation pumped, the blue-gray toes, dry and cracked. She had an ulcerated area about the size of a nickel on the inside aspect of her right ankle.
"I think I'll sit down a minute," I murmured.
"Well, honey, you're pale as a ghost. Go out to the kitchen and get a glass of juice."
The orange juice helped, and I ate a piece of toast, cleaning up the kitchen afterward as a way of avoiding the woman in the other room. 3,000 hours of investigative training hadn't quite prepared me for a sideline as a drudge. I felt like I'd spent half my time on this case washing dirty dishes. How come Magnum P.I. never had to do stuff like this? At 10:20, Maxine appeared, cleaning supplies in a plastic bucket on her arm. She was one of those women with an extra 100 pounds wobbling around her body like a barrel made of flesh. She had one eye tooth the size and color of a rusty nail. Without any pause, she took out a dust rag and began to work her way around the room.
"Sorry I'm late, but I couldn't get that old car to start to save my neck. I finally called and asked John Robert to come over with a set of jumper cables, but it took him a good half hour just to get there. I heard about Royce. God love his heart."
"I'm going to have Anne take me over there this evening," Ori said, "provided I feel well enough."
Maxine just clucked and shook her head.
"I tell you," she said, "and I bet you haven't heard a word from Bailey. No telling where he's at."
"Oh, and I'm worried sick. I never even laid eyes on him after all this time, and here he's took off again."
Maxine made a face that conveyed sympathy and regret, then flapped her dust rag to indicate a shift in tone.
"Mary Burney's making a perfect fool of herself.
Windows boarded up, big lock on the gate, convinced he'll go over there and carry her off.
Well, whatever for? Ori asked, completely mystified.
I never said she had brains, but then half the people I talk to are loading their guns. Radio says he may be seeking refuge among former acquaintances. Just like that, may be seeking refuge. Now, if that's not the silliest thing I ever heard. I told John Robert, Bailey's got more sense than that, I said. For one thing, he doesn't know Mary Burney from a hole in the ground, and besides which, he wouldn't go anywhere near that place of hers because it backs right up to the National Guard armory. Chain-link fence and all what kind of thing. Floodlights, Lord God. I said, Bailey may be a criminal, but he's not a retard.
As soon as I could decently insert myself into the conversation, I told Ori I'd be taking off. Maxine got conspicuously quiet, hoping no doubt to pick up some information she could pass along to John Robert and Mary Burney next chance she had. I avoided giving any indication where I meant to go. The last glimpse I had of them, Maxine was handing Ori a fistful of junk mail to sort through while she applied Lemon Pledge to the top of the bookshelf where the mail had been stacked. Tap Granger's widow lived on K Street, in a one-story frame house with a screened-in porch. The exterior was painted an ancient turquoise, trimmed in buttercup, the porch steps eaten through by something that left ominous holes in the wood. She came to the door looking pale and thin, except for the belly that jutted out in front of her like a globe. Her nose was a dull pink from tears, her eyes swollen with all the makeup cried off. Her hair had the tortured appearance of a recent home permanent. She wore faded jeans that hung on her narrow behind, a sleeveless T-shirt that left her bare arms bony-looking and puckered from the chilly morning air. She had a plump baby affixed to one hip, his massive thighs gripping her bulk like a horseman preparing to post. The pacifier in his mouth looked like some kind of plug you might pull if you wanted to let all the air out. Solemn eyes, runny nose.
"I'm sorry to bother you, Mrs. Granger. My name's Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator. Could I talk to you?"
"I guess," she said. She couldn't have been much more than 26, with the lackluster air of a woman drained of youth. Where was she going to find someone who'd take on another man's 5 kids?
The house was small and rustic, the construction crude, but the furnishings looked new. All Sears revolving charge account items, still under warranty. The couch and 2 matching Barca loungers were green naugahyde. The coffee table and the 2 end tables flanking the couch were blonde wood laminate, still unscarred by little children's shoes. The squat table lamps had pleated shades still wrapped in clear cellophane. She'd be paying it all off till the kids were in high school. She sat down on one couch cushion, which buckled up slightly and let out a sigh as the air was forced out. I perched on the edge of one lounge chair, uneasy about the half-eaten fluffernutter sandwich that kept me company on the seat.
"Lynetta, quit doing that!"
she sang out suddenly, though there didn't seem to be anyone else in the room. I realized belatedly that the twanging sound of a kid jumping up and down on a bed had just ceased. She shifted the baby, setting him on his feet. He swayed, clutching at her jeans, the pacifier wriggling around in his mouth as he started working it with a little humming sound.
"What did you want?" she said. "The police have been here twice, and I already told them everything I know."
"I'll try to be brief. It must be hard on you."
"Doesn't matter," she shrugged.
The stress of Tap's death had made her face break out, her chin splotched and fiery pink.
"Did you know what Tap was getting involved in yesterday?" "I knew he had some money, but he said he won a bet with this guy who finally paid up."
"A bet?"
"Might not have been true," she said, somewhat defensively, "but God knows we needed it, and I wasn't about to ask after it too close."
"Did you see him leave the house?"
"Not really. I'd come in from work, and I went straight to bed as soon as him and the kids left. I guess he dropped Ronnie and the girls off, and then took Mark to the sitters. He must have drove into San Luis Obispo after that. I mean, he had to, since that's where he ended up."
"But he never said anything about the breakout, or who put him up to it?"
"I wouldn't have stood for it if I'd known."
"Do you know how much he was paid?" Her eyes became wary in the blank of her face. She began to pick idly at her chin.
"Nuh-uh."
"No one's going to take it back. I just wondered how much it was."
"$2,000,
she murmured. "God,
A woman with no guile, married to a man with no sense. $2,000 to risk his life? Are you aware that the shotgun shells were loaded with rock salt? Again, she gave me that cagey look.
Tap said that way nobody'd get hurt.
Except him. Light dawned in that faraway world of the 98 IQ.
Oh.
Was the shotgun his?
Nuh-uh. Tap never had a gun. I wouldn't have one in the house with these kids, she said.
Do you have any idea at all who he was dealing with?
Some woman, I heard.
That got my attention. Really? Back went the hand to her chin. Pick, pick.
Somebody saw him together at the pool hall night before he died.
It took a split second. Shit, that was me. I was trying to get a lead on this Bailey Fowler business, and I knew they'd been friends.
Oh, I thought maybe him and some woman...
Absolutely not, I said. In fact, he spent half the time showing me pictures of you and the kids. She colored faintly, tears welling.
That's sweet. I wish I could help. You seem awful nice.
I took out my card and jotted down the number of the motel on the back. Here's where I'll be for the next couple of days. If you think of anything, get in touch.
Are you coming to the funeral? It's tomorrow afternoon at the Baptist Church. It should be a good turnout because everybody liked Tap.
I had my doubts about that, but it was clearly something she needed to believe. We'll see. I may be tied up, but I'll be there if I can. My recollection of Reverend Hawes made attendance unlikely, but I couldn't rule it out. I'd been present at a number of funerals over the last several months, and I didn't think I could endure another. Organized religion was ruined for me when I was 5 years old, subjected to a Sunday school teacher with hairs sticking out of her nose and bad breath. Trust me to point that out. The Presbyterians had suggested the vacation Bible school at the Congregational Church down the road. Since I'd already been expelled by the Methodists, my aunt was losing heart. Personally, I was looking forward to another flannel board. You could make baby Jesus with some fuzzies on his back and stick him right up in the sky like a bird, then make him dive-bomb the manger. Jolene left the baby sidestepping his way down the length of the couch while she walked me to the door. The bell rang almost simultaneously with her opening it. Dwight Shale stood on the doorstep, looking as surprised as we were. His glance shifted from her face to mine and then back again. He nodded at Jolene.
Thought I'd stop by and see how you were.
Thanks, Mr. Shales. That's real nice of you. This is,
I held out my hand. Kinsey Milhone, we've met. We shook hands.
I remember, he said. I just stopped by the motel, as a matter of fact. If you can hold on a minute, we can have a chat.
Sure, I said. I stood there while he and Jolene talked briefly. From their conversation, I gathered that she'd been at the high school not that many years before.
I just lost my wife, and I know how it feels, he was saying.
The authoritarian air I remembered was gone. His pain seemed so close to the surface it made tears well up in Jolene's eyes again.
I appreciate that, Mr. Shales. I do. Mrs. Shales was a nice woman, and I know she suffered something fierce. You want to come in? I can fix you some tea.
He glanced at his watch.
I can't this minute. I'm late as it is, but I'll stop by again. I wanted you to know we're all thinking of you over at the high school. Can I help you with anything? You have enough money?
Jolene seemed completely overwhelmed, nose turning rosy, her voice cracking when she spoke.
I'm all right. Mom and Daddy are coming up from Los Angeles tonight. I'll be fine as soon as they get here.
Will you let us know if there's anything we can do? I can have one of the senior girls look after the kids tomorrow afternoon. Bob Hawes said the services are scheduled for 2.
I'd appreciate the help. I hadn't even thought about who'd be keeping the kids. Will you be at the funeral? Tap'd be awful glad.
Of course I'll be there. He was a fine man, and we were all proud of him.
I followed him out to the street where his car was parked.
I pulled school records on Jean Timberlake, he said. If you want to stop by the office, you can see what we've got. You have a car? I can give you a lift.
I better take mine. It's back at the motel.
Hop in. I'll drop you off.
Are you sure? I don't want to hold you up.
Won't take a minute. I'm headed back in that direction anyway.
He held the door for me, and I got in, the two of us chatting inconsequentially during the brief ride back to the Ocean Street. I could have walked, but I was trying to ingratiate myself with the man in the hope that he might have personal recollections of his own to add to whatever data I found in Jean's file. Anne had returned from the hospital, and I saw her peer out of the office window as we pulled up. She and Shales exchanged a smile and a wave, and she disappeared. I stepped out of the car, leaning back toward the open window. "I have another errand to run, and then I'll pop by."
"Good. Meanwhile, I'll check and see if any of the staff have information to contribute."
"Thanks," I said. As he took off, I turned to find Anne right behind me. She seemed surprised to see him pull away.
"He's not coming in?"
"I think he had to get back to the school. I just ran into him over at Jolene Granger's."
"How's your father?"
Reluctantly, Anne's gaze flicked back to my face.
"About what you'd expect. Cancer spread to his lungs, liver, and spleen. They're saying now he probably has less than a month."
"How's he taking it?"
"Poorly. I thought he'd made his peace, but he seemed real upset. He wants to talk to you."
My heart sank. It was the last thing I needed, a conversation with the doomed. "I'll try to get up there sometime this afternoon." Chapter 15. I sat in the vestibule outside Dwight Shales's office, variously picking my way through the papers in Jean Timberlake's school file and eavesdropping on an outraged senior girl who'd been caught in the restroom shampooing her hair. Apparently, the drill in disciplinary matters was for the culprit to use the payphone in the school office to notify the appropriate parent about the nature of the offense.
"Well, guy, Mom, how was I to know? I mean, big fucking deal," she said.
"Because I didn't have time." "Kai! Well, nobody ever told me. It's a fucking free country. All I did was wash my hair."
"I did not. I'm not smarting off. Yeah, well, you have a big mouth, too."
Her tone shifted here from exasperation to extreme martyrdom, voice sliding up and down the scale.
"Okay." I said okay. "Oh, right, Mom. God, why ain't you ground me for life?" "Right. Oh, really, I'm sure. Fuck you, okay? You are such an asshole. I just hate you."
She slammed the phone down resoundingly and burst noisily into tears. I suppressed a temptation to peer around the corner at her. I could hear the low murmur of a fellow conspirator.
"God, Jennifer, that is just so unfair," the second girl said.
Jennifer was sobbing inconsolably.
"She is such a bitch. I hate her fucking guts."
I tried to picture myself at her age talking to my aunt like that. I'd have had to take out a loan for the ensuing dental work. I leafed through Jean's scholastic aptitude test scores, attendance records, the written comments her teachers had added from time to time. With the weeping in the background, it was almost like having Jean Timberlake's ghost looking on. She certainly seemed to have had her share of grief in high school. Tardiness, demerits, detention, parent-teacher conferences scheduled, and then canceled when Mrs. Timberlake failed to show. There were repeated notes from sessions with first one and then another of the four school counselors, Anne Fowler being one. Jean had spent a large part of her junior year consigned to Mr. Shales's office, sitting on the bench, perhaps sullenly, perhaps with the total self-possession she seemed to display in the few yearbook photographs I'd seen. Maybe she'd sat there and recollected in tranquility the lewd sexual experiments she'd conducted with the boys in the privacy of parked cars. Or maybe she'd flirted with one of the senior honors students manning the main desk. From the moment she reached puberty, her grade point average had slid steadily downward, despite the contradictory evidence of her IQ and past grades. I could practically feel the heat of noxious hormones seeping through the pages, the drama, confusion, finally the secrecy. Her confidences in the school nurse ceased abruptly. Where Mrs. Berenger had jotted down folksy notes about cramps and heavy periods, advising a consultation with the family physician, there was suddenly concern about the girl's mounting absenteeism. Jean's problems didn't go unnoticed or unremarked. To the credit of the faculty, a general alarm seemed to sound. From the paper trail left behind, it looked as if every effort had been made to bring her back from the brink. Then on November 5th,
Someone had noted in dark blue angular ink that the girl was deceased. The word was underlined once, and after that the page was blank.
Is that going to help?
I jumped. Dwight Shales had emerged from his inner office, and he stood now in the door. The weeping girl was gone, and I could hear the tramp of footsteps as the students passed between classes.
You scared me, I said, patting myself on the chest.
Sorry, come into the office. I've got a conference scheduled at 2, but we can talk till then. Bring the file.
I gathered up Jean's records and followed him in.
Have a seat, he said.
His manner had changed. The easygoing man I'd seen earlier had disappeared. Now he seemed guarded, careful of his words, all business, slightly curt, as if 20 years of dealing with unruly teenagers had soured him on everyone. I suspected his manner tended toward the autocratic anyway, his tone edged with combativeness. He was used to being in charge. On the surface he was attractive, but his good looks were posted with warning signs. His body was trim. He had the build and carriage of a former military type, accustomed to operating under fire. If he was a sportsman, I'd peg him as an expert in trap and skeet shooting. His games would be handball, poker, and chess. If he ran, he'd feel compelled to lower his finish by a few seconds each time out. Maybe once he'd been open, vulnerable or soft, but he was shut down now, and the only evidence I'd seen of any warmth at all was in his dealings with Jolene. Apparently his wife's death had ruptured the bounds of his self-control. In matters of mourning, he could still reach out. I took a seat, placing the fat, dog-eared manila folder on the desk in front of me. I hadn't found anything startling, but I'd made a few notes. Her former address, birth date, social security number, the bare bones of data made meaningless by her death.
What did you think of her? I asked him.
She was a tough little nut, I'll tell you that.
So I gathered. It looks like she spent half her time in detention.
At least that. What made it frustrating, for me at any rate, and you're welcome to talk to some of the other teachers about this, is that she was a very appealing kid. Smart, soft-spoken, friendly, with adults at any rate. I can't say she was well-liked among her classmates, but she was pleasant to the staff. You'd sit her down to have a chat, and you'd think you were getting through. She'd nod and agree with you, make all the proper noises, and then she'd turn around and do exactly what she'd been reprimanded for in the first place.
Can you give me an example?
Anything you name. She'd ditch school, show up late, fail to turn in assignments, refuse to take tests. She smoked on campus, which was strictly against the rules back then, kept booze in her locker, drove everybody up the wall. It's not like what she did was worse than anybody else. She simply had no conscience about it and no intention whatever of cleaning up her act. How do you deal with someone like that? She'd say anything that got her off the hook. This girl was convincing. She could make you believe anything she said, but then it would evaporate the minute she left the room.
Did she have any girlfriends?
Not that I ever saw.
Did she have a rapport with any teacher in particular?
I doubt it. You can ask some of the faculty if you like.
What about the promiscuity?
He shifted uncomfortably. I heard rumors about that, but I never had any concrete information. Wouldn't surprise me. She had some problems with self-esteem.
I talked with a classmate who implied that it was pretty steamy stuff.
Shales wagged his head reluctantly. There wasn't much we could do. We referred her 2 or 3 times for professional counseling, but of course she never went.
I take it the school counselors didn't make much progress.
I'm afraid not. I don't think you could fault us for the sincerity of our concern, but we couldn't force her to do anything, and her mother didn't help. I wish I had a nickel for every note we sent home. The truth is, we liked Jean and thought she had a chance. At a certain point, Mrs. Timberlake seemed to throw up her hands. Maybe we did too, I don't know. Looking back on the situation, I don't feel good, but I don't know how we could have done it any differently. She's just one of those kids who fell between the cracks. It's a pity, but there it is.
How well do you know Mrs. Timberlake at this point?
What makes you ask?
I'm being paid to ask.
She's a friend, he said after the barest hesitancy.
I waited, but he didn't amplify. What about the guy Jean was allegedly involved with?
You've got me on that. A lot of stories started circulating right after she died, but I never heard a name attached.
Can you think of anything else that might help? Someone she might have taken into her confidence?
Not that I recall.
A look crossed his face.
Well, actually, there was one thing that always struck me as odd. A couple times that fall I saw her at church, which seemed out of character.
Church?
Bob Hawes' congregation. I forget who told me, but the word was she had the hots for the kid who headed up the youth group over there. Now what the hell was his name? Hang on. He got up and went to the door to the main office.
Kathy, what was the name of the boy who was treasurer of the senior class the year Jean Timberlake was killed? You remember him?
There was a pause and a murmured response that I couldn't quite hear.
Yeah, here's the one. Thanks.
Dwight Shales turned back to me.
John Clemson. His dad's the attorney representing Fowler, isn't he?
I parked in the little lot behind Jack Clemson's office, taking the flagstone path around the cottage to the front. The sun was out, but the breeze was cool, and the pittosporums shading the side yard were being hedged up by a man in a landscape company uniform. The little Wonder electric trimmer in his hands made a chirping sound as he passed it across the face of the shrub, which was raining down leaves. I went up on the porch, pausing for a moment before I let myself in. All the way over I'd been rehearsing what I'd say, feeling not a little annoyed that he'd withheld information. Maybe it would turn out to be insignificant, but that was mine to decide. The door was ajar, and I stepped into the foyer. The woman who glanced up must have been his regular secretary. She was in her 40s, petite, nay, toy-sized, hair hennaed to an auburn shade with piercing gray eyes and a silver bracelet, in a snake shape, coiled around her wrist.
"Is Mr. Clemson in?"
"Is he expecting you?"
"I stopped by to bring him up to date on a case," I said. "The name is Kinsey Milhone."
She took in my outfit, gaze traveling from turtleneck to jeans to boots, with an almost imperceptible flicker of distaste. I probably looked like someone he might represent on a charge of welfare fraud.
"Just a moment. I'll check."
Her look said, "Not bloody likely." Instead of buzzing through, she got up from her desk and tippy-tapped her way down the hall to his office, flared skirt twitching on her little hips as she walked. She had the body of a 10-year-old. Idly, I surveyed her desk while she was gone, scanning the document that she was working from. Reading upside down is only one of several obscure talents I've developed working as a private eye. "And he is enjoined and restrained from annoying, molesting, threatening, or harming petitioner." Given the average marriage these days, this sounded like prenups.
"Kinsey, hey, nice to see you. Come on back."
Clemson was standing in the door to his office. He had his suit jacket off, shirt collar unbuttoned, sleeves rolled up, and tie askew. The gabardine pants looked like the same ones he'd had on 2 days ago, bunched up in the seat, pleated with wrinkles across the lap. I followed him into his office in the wake of cigarette smoke. His secretary tippy-tapped back to her desk out front, radiating disapproval. Both chairs were crowded with law books, tongues of scrap paper hanging out where he'd marked passages. I stood while he cleared a space for me to sit down. He moved around to his side of the desk, breathing audibly. He stubbed out his cigarette with a shake of his head.
"Out of shape," he remarked.
He sat down, tipping back in his swivel chair.
"What are we going to do with that Bailey, huh? Guy's a fucking lunatic, taken off like that."
I filled him in on Bailey's late-night call, repeating his version of the escape, while Jack Clemson pinched the bridge of his nose and shook his head in despair.
"What a jerk. No accounting for the way these guys see things."
He reached for a letter and gave it a contemptuous toss.
"Look at this. Know what that is? Hate mail. Some guy got put away 22 years ago when I was a PD. He writes me every year from jail like it's something I did to him. Jesus! When I was in the AG's office, the AG did a survey of prisoners as to who they blamed for their conviction. You know, why are you in prison and whose fault is it? Nobody ever says, 'It's my fault for being a jerk.' The number one guy who gets blamed is their own lawyer. If I'd have had a real lawyer instead of a PD, I'd have got off. That's the number one guy, okay? His own lawyer. The number two guy that was blamed was the witness who testified against him. Number three, are you ready? Is the judge who sentenced him. If I'd have had a fair judge, this would have never happened. Number four was the police who investigated the case, the investigating officer, whoever caught him. And way down there at the bottom was the prosecuting attorney. Less than 10% of the people they surveyed could even remember the prosecutor's name. I'm in the wrong end of the business."
He snorted and leaned forward on his elbows, shoving files around on his desk.
Anyway, skip that. How's it going from your end? You coming up with anything?
I don't know yet, I said carefully. I just talked to the principal at Central Coast High. He tells me he saw Jean at the Baptist Church a couple of times in the months before she was killed. Word was she was infatuated with your son.
Dead silence.
Mine, he said. I shrugged noncommittally. Kid named John Clemson. I assume he's your son. Was he the student leader of the church youth group?
Well, yeah, John did that, but it's news to me about her.
He never said anything to you?
No, but I'll ask.
Why don't I?
A pause.
Jack Clemson was too much the professional to object.
Sure, why not?
He jotted an address and a telephone number on a scratch pad.
This is his business.
He tore the leaf off and passed it across the desk to me, locking eyes with me.
He's not involved in her death.
I stood up.
Let's hope not.
Chapter 16. The business address I'd been given turned out to be a 700-square-foot pharmacy at one end of a medical facility half a block off Higuera. The complex itself bore an eerie resemblance to the Padres' quarters of half the California missions I'd seen. Thick adobe walls, complete with decorator cracks, a long colonnade of 21 arches with a red tile roof, and what looked like an aqueduct tucked into the landscaping. Pigeons were misbehaving up among the eaves, managing to copulate on a perilously tiny ledge. The pharmacy, amazingly, did not sell beach balls, lawn furniture, children's clothing, or motor oil. To the left of the entrance were tidy displays of dental wares, feminine hygiene products, hot water bottles, and heating pads, corn remedies, body braces of diverse kinds, and colostomy supplies. I browsed among the over-the-counter medications while the pharmacist's assistant chatted with a customer about the efficacy of vitamin E for hot flashes. The place had a faintly chemical scent, reminiscent of the sticky coating on fresh Polaroid prints. The man I took to be John Clemson was standing behind a shoulder-high partition in a white coat, his head bent to his work. He didn't look at me, but once the customer left, he murmured something to his assistant, who leaned forward.
"Miss Milhone," she said.
She wore pants and a yellow polyester smock with patch pockets, one of those uniforms that would serve equally for a waitress, an au pair, or an LVN.
"Yes." "You want to step back here, please? We're swamped this morning, but John says he'll talk to you while he works, if that's all right."
"That's fine, thanks." She lifted a hinged portion of the counter, holding it for me while I ducked underneath and came up in a narrow alleyway. The counter on this side was lined with machinery. Two computer monitors, a typewriter, a label maker, a printer, and a microfiche reader. Storage bins below the counter were filled with empty translucent plastic pill vials. Ancillary labels on paper rolls were hung in a row, stickers cautioning the recipient, "Shake well. This prescription cannot be refilled. Will cause discoloration of urine or feces, external use only, and do not freeze." On the right were the drug bays, floor-to-ceiling shelves stocked with antibiotics, liquids, topical ointments, and oral medications, arranged alphabetically. I had, within easy reach, the cure for most of life's ills. Depression, pain, tenderness, apathy, insomnia, heartburn, fever, infection, obsession, and dizziness, excitability, seizures, histrionics, remorse. Given my poor night's sleep, what I needed were uppers, but it seemed unprofessional to whine and beg. I'd expected John Clemson to look like his father, but he couldn't have been more different. He was tall and lean, with a thatch of dark hair. His face in profile was thin and lined, his cheeks sunken, cheekbones prominent. He had to be my age, but he had a worn air about him, an aura of weariness, ill health, or despair. He made no eye contact, his attention fixed on the task in front of him. Using a spatula, he was sliding pills by fives across the surface of a counting tray. With a rattle, he tumbled pills into a groove on the side, funneling them into an empty plastic vial, which he sealed with a childproof cap. He affixed a label, set the vial aside, and started again, working with the same automatic grace as a dealer in Vegas. Thin wrists, long, slender fingers. I wondered if his hands would smell of physoderm.
"Sorry I can't interrupt what I'm doing," he said mildly. "What can I help you with?"
His tone had a light mocking quality, as if something amused him that he might or might not reveal.
"I take it your father called. How much did he tell you?"
"That you're investigating the murder of Gene Timberlake at his request. I know, of course, that he was hired to represent Bailey Fowler. I don't know what you want with me."
"You remember Gene?"
"Yes."
I had hoped for something a little more informative, but I was willing to press.
"Can you tell me about your relationship with her?"
His mouth curved up slightly.
"My relationship?"
"Somebody told me she used to hang out at the Baptist church. As I understand it, you were a classmate of hers and headed up the youth group back then. I thought maybe the two of you developed a friendship."
"Jean didn't have friends. She had conquests."
"Were you one?"
A bemused smile.
"No." What was the damn joke here?
"Do you remember her coming to church?"
"Oh, yes, but it wasn't me she was interested in. I wish I could say it was. She was very particular, our Miss Timberlake."
"Meaning what?"
"Meaning she'd never have tumbled for the likes of me."
"Oh, really? Why is that?"
He turned his face. The whole right side was disfigured, right eye missing, the lid welded shut by shiny pink and silver scar tissue that extended from his scalp to his jaw. His good eye was large and dark, filled with self-awareness. The missing eye created the illusion of a constant wink. I could see now that his right arm was also badly scarred.
"What was it?"
"Automobile accident when I was 10. The gas tank blew up. My mother died, and I was left looking like this. It's better now. I've had surgery twice. Back then, the church was my salvation, literally. I was baptized when I was 12, dedicating my life to Jesus. Who else would have me? Certainly not Jean Timberlake."
"Were you interested in her?"
"Sure I was. I was 17 years old and doomed to be a virgin for life. My bad luck. Good looks ranked high with her because she was so beautiful herself. After that came money, power, sex, of course. I thought about her incessantly. She was so completely venal."
"But not with you."
He went back to his work, sliding pills into the trough.
"Unfortunately not."
"Who then?" The lips curved up again in that nearly beatific smile. "Well, let's see now. How much trouble should I make?"
I shrugged, watching him carefully.
"Just tell me the truth. What else can you do?"
"I could keep my mouth shut, which is what I've done to date."
"Maybe it's time to speak up," I said. He was quiet for a moment.
"Who is she involved with?"
His smile finally disappeared.
"The Right Reverend Hawes. What a pal he turned out to be. He knew I lusted after her, so he counseled me in matters of purity and self-control. He never mentioned what he did with her himself."
I stared at him.
"Are you sure of that?"
"She worked at the church, cleaning Sunday school rooms. Wednesdays at 4 o'clock, before choir practice started, he would pull his pants down around his knees and lie back across his desk while she worked on him. I used to watch from the vestry. Mrs. Hawes, our dear June, suffers from a peculiar stigmata that originated just about that time. Resistant to treatment. I know because I fill the prescriptions, one right after the other. Amusing, don't you think?"
A chill rippled down my back. The image was vivid, his tone matter-of-fact.
"Who else is aware of this?"
"No one, as far as I know."
"You never mentioned it to anybody at the time?"
"Nobody asked, and I've since left the church. It turned out not to be the kind of comfort I was hoping for."
The San Luis County Clerk's office is located in the annex right next door to the county courthouse on Monterey. It was hard to believe that only yesterday we were all convening for Bailey's arraignment. I found a parking place across the street, inserted coins in the meter, then headed past the big redwood and into the annex entrance. The corridor was lined with marble, a cold gray with darker streaks. The county clerk's office was on the first floor, through double doors. I set to work. Using Jean Timberlake's full name and the date of birth I'd pulled from her school records, I found the volume and page number listing her birth certificate. The records clerk looked up the original certificate, and for $11 made me a certified copy. I didn't much care if it was certified or not. What interested me was the information it contained. Etta Jean Timberlake was born at 2:26 a.m. on June 3, 1949.
6 pounds, 8 ounces, 19 inches long. Her mother was listed as Gravida 1, Para 1, 15 years old, and unemployed. Her father was unknown. The attending physician was Joseph Dunn. I found a public phone and looked up his office. The number rang 4 times, and then his answering service picked up. He was out on Thursdays, not due in again till Monday morning at 10. Do you know how I can reach him?
Dr. Corsell's on call. If you'll leave your name and number, we can have him get in touch.
What about the hot springs? Could Dr. Dunn be up there?
Are you a patient of his?
I set the receiver back in the cradle and let myself out of the booth. Since I was already downtown, I debated briefly about stopping by the hospital to see Royce. Anne said he was asking for me, but I didn't want to talk to him just yet. I drove back toward Floral Beach, taking one of the back roads, an undulating band of asphalt that wound past ranches, walled tract estates, and new housing developments. There were very few cars in the spa's parking lot. The hotel couldn't be doing enough business to sustain the good doctor and his wife. I angled my VW in close to the main building, noting, as I had before, the dense chill in the air. The sulfur smell of spoiled eggs conjured up images of some befouled nest. This time I bypassed the spa entrance and went around to the front, up wide concrete stairs to the wraparound porch. A row of chaise longues lent the veranda the look of a ship's deck. Under a canopy of oaks, the ground sloped down gradually, leveling out then for 100 yards until it met the road. On my left, in an area cleared of trees, I caught a glimpse of the deserted swimming pool in a flat oblong of sunlight. 2 tennis courts occupied the only other portion of the property graced with sun. The surrounding fence was screened by shrubs, but the hollow puck, puck suggested that at least 1 court was in use. I pushed through a double-wide door of carved mahogany, the upper half inset with glass. The lobby was built on a grand scale, rimmed with wooden balustrades, flooded with light from 2 translucent glass skylights. The main salon was currently undergoing renovation. The carpeting was obscured by yards of gray canvas dropcloth, speckled with old paint. Scaffolding erected along 2 walls suggested that the wood paneling was in the process of being sanded and refinished. Here, at least, the harsh smell of varnish overrode the pungent aroma of the mineral springs that burbled under the property like a cauldron. The registration desk ran the width of the lobby, but there was no one in evidence. No reception clerk, no bellman, no painters at work. The silence had a quality about it that caused me to glance back over my shoulder, scanning the second-floor gallery. There was no one visible. Shadows hung among the eaves like spiderwebs. Wide carpeted hallways extended on either side of the desk back into the gloomy depths of the hotel. I waited a decent interval in the silence. No one appeared. I pivoted, doing a 180 turn while I surveyed the place. Time to nose around, I thought. Casually, I ambled down the corridor on the right, my passage making no sound on the densely carpeted floors. Halfway down the wall, glass-paned doors opened into a vast semicircular dining room with a wooden floor, furnished with countless round oak dining tables and matching ladder-backed chairs. I crossed to the bay windows on the far side of the room. Through the watery ripples of old glass, I saw the tennis players leave the courts, heading my way. There were 2 sets of wooden swinging doors down to my left. I tiptoed the length of the room and peered into the hotel kitchen. A dull illumination from the kitchen windows cast a gray light against the expansive stainless steel counter. Stainless steel fixtures, chrome, old linoleum, heavy white crockery was stacked on open shelves. The room might have been a museum exhibit, the modern style revisited, the kitchen of the future, circa 1966. I moved back toward the corridor, the murmur of voices. I slipped into the triangle formed by the dining room door and the wall, pressing myself flat. Through the hinged crack, I saw Mrs. Dunn pass in a tennis outfit, racket under one arm. She had legs about as shapely as a pair of Doric columns, capped by the rims of her underpants, which extended unbecomingly from the flounce of short skirt. A varicose vein wound along one calf like a vine. Not 1 strand of her white blonde hair was out of place. I assumed her companion was her husband, Dr. Dunn. They were gone in a flash, voices receding. The only impression I had of him was of curly white hair, pink skin, and portliness.
As soon as they disappeared from sight, I slipped out of my hiding place and returned to the lobby. A woman in a burnt orange hotel blazer was now standing at the registration desk. Her gaze flicked toward the corridor when she saw me emerge, but she was apparently too schooled in proper desk clerk behavior to quiz me about where I'd been. "I was just having a look around," I said. "I may want to book a room." "The hotel's closed for 3 months for renovation. We'll be open again April 1st. "Do you have a brochure?" "Certainly." She reached under the counter, automatically producing one. She was in her 30s, probably with a degree in hotel management, no doubt wondering if she was wasting her professional training in a place that smelled like a faulty garbage disposal. I glanced at the pamphlet she'd handed me, a match for the one I'd seen at the motel. "Is this Dr. Dunn around? I'd like to talk to him."
"He just came in from the tennis courts. You must have passed him in the hall."
I shook my head, baffled. "I didn't see anyone."
"Just a moment, I'll ring."
She picked up an in-house telephone, turning away from me so I couldn't read her lips while she murmured to someone on the other end. She replaced the receiver.
"Mrs. Dunn will be right out."
"Great. Do you have a restroom close by?" She pointed down the corridor to the left of the desk.
"Second door down."
"I'll be right back." I was telling a little fib. The minute I was out of sight, I race-walked down the corridor to the far end where it met a transverse corridor with administrative offices on either side. All of them were empty except for one. A nice brass plaque identified it as Dr. Dunn's. I went in. He didn't seem to be there, but the chair was piled with sweaty tennis togs, and I could hear the patter of a shower being run behind a door marked private. I took the liberty of a stroll around his desk while I waited for him. I let my fingers tippy-toe among his papers, but there was nothing of interest. A detail man had been here and had left some samples of a new anticholinergic with accompanying literature. The glossy color enlargement showed a duodenal ulcer as large as the planet Jupiter. Oh, barf! Picture that sucker sitting in your gut. The file cabinets were locked. I had hoped to explore his desk drawers, but I didn't want to push my luck. Some people get cranky when you snoop around like that. I cupped one hand to my ear. Shower off. Ah, that was good. The doctor and I were going to have a little chat. Chapter 17. Dr. Dunn emerged from the bathroom fully dressed, wearing Kelly green slacks with a white belt, a pink and green plaid sport shirt, white loafers, pink socks. All he needed was a white sports coat to constitute what's known as a full Cleveland, very popular among middle-aged bon vivants in the Midwest. He had a full head of white hair, still damp, combed straight back. Tendrils were already curling up around his ears. His face was full, his complexion hot pink, eyes very blue under unruly white brows. He was probably 6'2", toting an extra 50 pounds worth of rich food and drink, which he carried in the front like 6 months' worth of pregnancy. How come all the men in this town were out of shape? He stopped in his tracks when he caught sight of me.
"Yes, ma'am," he said in response to some question I hadn't asked him yet.
I infused my tone with warmth, feigning graciousness. "Hi, Dr. Dunn. I'm Kinsey Milhone," I said, extending my hand. He responded with a minimal squeeze, three fingers pressing mine.
"Personnel's down the hall, but we're not hiring presently.
The hotel won't open for business until April 1st. I'm not looking for work. I need some information about a former patient of yours." His eyes took on that doctor privilege look.
"And who would that be?"
"Gene Timberlake." His body language switched over to a code I couldn't read.
"Are you with the police?"
I shook my head. "I'm a private detective hired by..."
"I can't help you, then.
Mind if I sit?" He stared at me blankly, accustomed to his pronouncements being taken as law. He probably never had to deal with pushy people like me. He was protected from the public by his receptionist, his lab tech, his nurse, his billing clerk, his answering service, his office manager, his wife. An army of women keeping doctors safe and untouched.
"I must not have made myself clear, Miss Milhone. We have nothing to discuss."
"Sorry to hear that," I said equably. "I'm trying to find out who her father was."
"Who let you in here?"
"The desk clerk just talked to your wife," I said, which was true, but not relevant.
Young lady, I'm going to have to ask you to leave. There's no way in the world I'd give you information about the Timberlakes. I've been the personal physician to that family for years.
I understand that, I said. I'm not asking you to breach confidentiality.
You most certainly are.
Dr. Dunn, I'm trying to get a line on a murder suspect. I know Jean was illegitimate. I've got a copy of the birth certificate listing her father as unknown. I don't see any reason to protect the man if you know who he is. If you don't, just say so and save us both some time.
This is a damn outrage, barging in on me like this. You have no right to pry into that poor girl's past. Excuse me,
he said darkly, crossing the door.
Elva,
he yelled.
El?
I could hear someone thumping purposefully down the corridor. I put a business card on the edge of his desk. I'm at the Ocean Street Motel if you decide to help. I was halfway out the door when Mrs. Dunn appeared. She was still in tennis clothes, her pale cheeks flushed. I could see that she recognized me from my first visit to the place. My return wasn't greeted with the delight I had hoped for. She was holding her racket like a hatchet, the wooden rim edgewise. I eased away, keeping an eye on her. I don't usually feel that threatened by horsey women with big legs, but she had already stepped across the line into my psychological space. She moved forward a step, standing so close now I could smell her breath. No big treat. I was hoping to get some help on a case, but I guess I was wrong.
Call the police, she said flatly to him.
Without any warning, she lifted the racket like a samurai sword. I skipped back as the racket swapped down at me.
Whoa, lady, you better watch that, I said.
She struck out at me again, missing. I had dodged in reflex. Hey, knock it off! She whacked at me again, fanning the air within an inch of my face. I jerked back. This was ludicrous. I wanted to laugh, but the racket had hissed with a savagery that made my stomach lurch. I danced backward as she advanced. She swatted again with the Wilson and missed. Her face had taken on an expression of avid concentration, eyes glittering, lips parted slightly. Behind her, I was dimly aware that Dr. Dunn's attitude had shifted from wariness to concern.
Elva, that's enough, he said.
I didn't think she'd heard him, or if she had, she didn't care. The racket whacked at me sideways, wielded this time like a broadaxe. She shifted her weight, her grip two-handed as she sliced diagonally and sliced again. Whack, whack! Missing me by a hair's breadth, and only because I was quick. She was totally focused, and I was afraid if I turned to run, she'd catch me in the back of the head. Take a crack like that, and you're talking blood, folks.